Donald on the Kitchen talks about food. Donald on the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donald on the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And we gather here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames, Iowa. Oh, Donna, this is the time of the year where it seems everything all at once is happening. The garden is going nuts. And every time I step out there, it's, well, you better harvest me now, and you better harvest it. And this is ripe, and that is ripe.
So, oh, yeah. The farmers markets are full. Now we've got melons, eggplants, peppers, tomatoes, corn, everything you could wish for.
Ooh, I got a real good melon at the Ames Farm.
Oh, me too.
Thanks to Nicole from Red Granite Farm, because she pointed in a big pile and said, that one, and that one was ripe. So good for her. So here comes the garden produce. It is going nuts. So how do farmers manage it all? There is this amazing amount of work to do, and you kind of have to know what you're doing to get a crop out of the ground, especially when everything is happening all at once. So joining us at the kitchen table today are the fine folks from Sundog Farm and Local Harvest CSA, Carmen and Maya Black. Welcome to our table.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good. So, Sundog Farm is in Solon, Iowa, which is, it's kind of north and east of Ames. We're here in the center of town, or center of the state. So, tell us about your farm, and tell us about the team of farmers that you have to help you.
Yeah, so this is Carmen, and I'm Maya. And I think our voices sound very similar.
So, sisters.
Yeah, we're sisters. So we'll try to identify ourselves when we start talking. I'm Carmen. And I bought this farm that we named Sundog Farm and the Local Harvest CSA business from a retiring farmer, Susan Utes, who started Local Harvest CSA in the early 90s. So she was one of the first CSA farmers in Iowa and really paved the way for the CSA model in the state, as well as setting an example of being a woman farmer. And Maya and I grew up just a mile away. So we've known Susan forever, and
she was our 4-H leader growing up.
Oh, how nice!
And so we both worked for Susan for a few summers before she retired, she let me know one summer when we were picking melons. I was around this time of year, actually, in August. That she wanted to retire and that she knew that I wanted to farm, but that I had said I wasn't ready yet. So she just wanted me to know that she was pretty close to retirement. So I did a lot of soul searching and determined that this would be like a really excellent opportunity to start farming a mile from my mom. And so we had a full transition year of Susan and I living together and to figure out how to make the farm transition work and also to like continue training.
On the job Maya training, was, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Maya was still in college.
Yeah, I was still finishing college at that time. So I was like working on the farm over the summers, but still figuring out my life direction. And then when Carmen was setting out to do her first season without Susan, she was a little nervous, understandably. So she said, Maya, you have to come back and farm with me. And so I did, and I have never wanted to leave. So,
What's the age difference between you two?
We're about 6 years apart.
Ah, okay.
Well, how wonderful to have a up and running farm and a gentle transition. I wouldn't say it was without a lot of soul searching and hard work, but good for you. It's wonderful. So, how long have you been doing your farm as Sundog Farm?
Yeah, so this is our 8th season since the farm transition. And not only did Maya continue, but Carlos Williams also worked for Susan and has stayed working on the farm. And just last year launched his own farm business on the farm. Called Williams Topsoil, and he raises meat chickens that we sell to our CSA customers as well.
Oh, and then also after 2016, one of my old friends from middle school and high school, Helena Thompson, also came out and started joining us on the farm. And then a couple years later, she joined us full time. So now it's the two of us plus Helena and Carlos on the farm.
I think there's plenty of work for everybody. The idea of having a space, but there's space to do a lot of different things on the farm. So what do you grow? You mentioned Carlos's chickens and other things. What are the things you grow on your farm?
Yeah, so the primary operation is Local Harvest CSA, which is community supported agriculture, where our members who live in Iowa City, Cedar Rapids, North Liberty, Solon, and the surrounding areas sign up at the beginning of the season, and then once a week get a share of what's in season on the farm. So we actually do a spring, summer, and fall and winter CSA seasons. So we're delivering vegetables from May through December, at least, and we have gone into January in the past. It kind of depends on the winter season.
Mm-hmm.
We just grow every kind of vegetable we can because we try to keep it interesting for that long season. So that's a big chunk of what we do is the mixed vegetables, and then Maya's going to talk about the rest.
And then in addition to that, we raise sheep. We have some goats, and just about exactly a year ago, we started raising laying hens. So we have about 600 laying hens that we market the eggs primarily to our CSA and to some local restaurants and bakeries.
That's a lot of hens.
That's a lot. Well, how many CSA members do you have, sort of?
We feed about 200 families during the summer season.
Mm. 200 lucky families.
The spring and fall and winter seasons are usually a little smaller, both due to the sort of vegetables that we grow, but also with season extension, we can't offer quite as many.
Well, good job for being, well, so you have a lot of things available for a lot of the year in Iowa. Kudos to you. That is great. I think Donna had a chicken question.
I did. Well, first of all, I want to acknowledge that you guys are sort of the poster children of successful beginning farmers here in Iowa. So congratulations. I know it's a rough thing to do. And I feel like because you started out with Susan Utz's experience, that has really given you a basis for success. So that's why we wanted to talk to you about what it was like at this point. I did see that you are selling Red Ranger chickens. Very special. Tell us about them.
Yeah, so that's one of, so like we mentioned, Carlos has his own chicken business on the farm. And so he raises a couple different kinds of chickens.
And I think, is it safe to say that the Red Rangers are his favorite? Definitely.
Well, in culinary circles, they have a fabulous reputation.
Yeah, he raises Red Rangers and the Cornish crosses, and just really admires how, like, much more of a chicken the Red Rangers are. They are excellent foragers, and they keep things interesting. I think he really likes to see how they grow. And yeah, they maybe have a little bit more going on in their brains than the Cornish crosses do.
Well, and they're people love them and probably pay extra for them because they're supposed to be very flavorful with, you know, more dark meat and things like that. So it's a rare culinary treat. Now his chickens are in addition to all of your layers that you have.
Yeah. Yeah, and the laying hens, actually, we had the opportunity to learn from and take over. Another neighbor wanted to get out of the egg business, Eric Menzel, and so we were able to transition to caring for the chickens in the same location that he was. So they're actually about a 6-minute drive away from our farm. And this is sort of one of the collaboration topics that we're excited to talk about at this field day is, like, we were able to transition into raising kind of a lot of laying hens from, like, we had, like, 15 personal laying hens on the farm. And we were able to do that because of the support and mentorship that we got. And he had a really excellent setup. So, yeah.
Good
it's
job.
A lot of chickens.
It is a lot of chickens.
Well, and I just want to tell our audience that this is a big deal because the average age of farmers in Iowa is pretty old. So there has been a lot of concern about kind of next generation farmers. And Carmen and Maya are real good examples of how this is working. I mean, we're not talking about corn and soybeans. They're actually raising food. So... Yeah. And now 600 laying hens, wowzers.
Also, Maya, you mentioned the upcoming field day. You are actually going to invite folks out to your place to see this, and it sounds like a wonderful visit, and it's kind of a special thing. The Practical Farmers of Iowa organizes these events all summer, and this is one of them. Actually, there are two things going on. There's going to be a tour of your home with a tour of your farm, and also I want to say farms because you're talking about collaboration in the area, and a farm doesn't have to be just one farm. It's many it says 5 locations, and also as part of this field, there's another separate field day. Well, morning, afternoon, a discussion of tools on a farm of your size, and we'll get into that in a little bit, but I want to talk more about your farm in general. Back to your animals. You have sheep and goats. What kind of sheep do you raise?
This is a good question. We raise wool sheep, and currently our flock is sort of a cross of Dorset, Suffolk, and Ile-de-France. Mm-hmm. We started when we transitioned from Susan, they were Dorset Suffolk cross. And then we started bringing in the Ile-de-France genetics because it's a really good pasture based breed, with really good parasite resistance. So we've been pretty happy with that. And I think we're going to keep sort of staying in the middle. We're not going in one breed direction, but and when Maya says a wool sheep, she means as opposed to a hair sheep.
Yeah,
not actually raising them for wool. So
you're slaughtering them before you have to shear them. Is that how you're doing it?
The lamb, we do have to shear the ewes. So we have a flock of ewes that we breed every year. And then we currently, as of this year, we will finish and market every lamb born on the farm, to, customers and restaurants.
So how many is that sort of
It will be, well, I guess we have 60 lambs right now, and we will save some of them for the flock. So it'll be in the ballpark of 50.
That, again,
that's a lot.
A lot of chickens, a lot of sheep. Oh, very good. One more thing before we go to a break here. You're always, it sounds like you've got lots of innovation and things you're always thinking about. Is this a new thing of your vegetable freezing packing facility? Talk about that.
Is a freeze pack processing facility?
Vegetables come again all at once, it seems. So it sounds like a really good thing to have on your farm. Talk about that.
Yeah, so we mentioned earlier that we're trying to grow vegetables for a long season. And we realized that it would be nice in some of the winter months, we really enjoy freezing like peppers and tomatoes, for example, for ourselves to enjoy in the winter. But we couldn't do that for our customers because you need to have a processing plant license in order to be able to chop and even freeze vegetables. Even if you're not cooking them, you need to be a processing plant. So we've been working on this project for 3 years and are excited that we have now a license processing facility on the farm so that we're able to do use some of the vegetables that we wouldn't be able to use in the CSA because they're kind of damaged. They're not as you know, marketable is what they say, but we can still use them to cut off that part and process them, and then they can appear in the share in the winter months.
So what do and you get a little freezer bag of what?
We're currently sort of experimenting with what is working, but it's definitely going to include tomatoes and peppers, dehydrated herbs. I think we're going to do dehydrated summer squash and frozen greens like kale and collards. I just wanted to say this is coming from also a place of in our experimentation with doing a winter CSA share. The customers get a little tired of turnips and cabbages and the storage crops, which are really great. But this, in addition to, like, things we can grow in our high tunnel and the storage crops, offering some of these, like, iconic summer vegetables in a frozen form that the customers can still use over the winter, we think will diversify the winter share in a nice way.
It's a good idea. Are you planning on hiring or getting more people involved? Are you going to spend your time chopping and freezing too? Sounds like more employment opportunities coming up here.
Yeah, so that's an excellent question. And I did want to say that this processing kitchen has really been led by Helena Thompson, who we mentioned earlier, farms with us. And this has really been her project that she's moved forward. So that's certainly one of the many collaborations. And then, yes, so we mentioned the folks that are sort of part of the core team of the farm, but we didn't mention that we have, like, many, many more people involved with the farm than that, including a sort of large group of high schoolers that have been working for us for the past few summers. And so that was one of the reasons that we actually were interested in putting in the processing kitchen, is to be able to continue to offer like more employment, and also not just seasonal employment. Between the eggs and the processing kitchen, we're hoping to extend the season that folks can work on the farm, even like through most of the year.
That sounds like a good idea.
So you're making more beginning farmers.
Yes. I'd like to take this opportunity to say this is KHOI Community Radio. Listen to the Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa.
Thank you.
Welcome back. We are talking about farming with two young farmers that are just doing great things here in Iowa. We're talking to Carmen and Maya Black, the founders and the energy behind Sundog Farm and Local Harvest CSA. They have Practical Farmers of Field Day coming up on
August 20th.
August 20th, coming right up. And they're going to be talking then. There'll be a tour of their farm, which sounds wonderful because they're about collaboration and growing good things, always trying new things. Also, they have another kind of offshoot, another field day at the same day.
In the morning.
And they're going to be talking about tools. There's a note here in the field day guide, Carmen and Maya, that you really like tools and how they have helped. Can you mention that? And why did you decide to offer a field day about tools?
This is a great question. I think in our journey as young farmers, beginning farmers, we have had just such a steep learning curve in terms of using tools, from hand tools to tractor equipment, and like learning how to use different implements for the tractor and actually purchasing some of our own. And we just feel like this is one of the biggest obstacles to getting into farming, is either not understanding or thinking you won't be able to understand how to use tools and equipment. And as young women, we additionally, I think, faced sort of like figuring out things that we had learned how to use when we were younger and things that we were never taught how to use. And sort of in the environment of our farm, ended up teaching ourselves how to use. And that has been a really empowering experience. And we have figured out, like, at the scale of vegetables that we produce, that our tools and equipment are critically important to us not breaking down physically or emotionally. And so we just feel like the biggest proponents of leaning into tools and equipment, and want to share some of the things we've learned in the past couple of years.
Because that's what's helped you scale up, right, in your vegetable production?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it certainly helped us scale up, and also just helped us to do what we're already doing more efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
So I think getting more confident with tools can just allow things to go faster, you know, as well.
Yeah, so. I can relate to your experience of not quite being taught things about tractors and all of the I like to refer to the things around my farm that my husband kind of takes care of, all the greasy stuff, you know, he knows how to do that, and I avoided that, but you can't, and well, I don't want to, and so I have learned things that about tractors and machines and tools. It does help a whole lot, and I must there's a lot of things I have to learn, but I wish to throw a bit of admiration out for anybody who can deal well on a tractor, and that includes, I mean, it's not just driving the tractor. There's usually something attached to the back that one has to mind too, and also anybody that can back up a tractor or a truck with a trailer on it. My heart goes out, and my appreciation goes out to the people that learn how to do that. So thanks for diving in with both feet and learning these things, Carmen and Maya. It is a good thing to do. Tell us about your tractors.
Yeah, you've got in your field day that you're going to be talking about tractors ranging from 20 to 100 horsepower. Now, this is for vegetable scale farming. We're not talking about 12-row corn planters or anything like that.
30-row down.
30-row.
The big, big honkers.
Okay, right.
Okay. Yeah, tell us about the kind of tractors and equipment that you have.
Yeah, so we were, again, very fortunate that Susan already had several tractors that we were able to buy along with the farm. And so that was a great start, because obviously finding the right size and scale of equipment that works is like one of the many challenges. I do feel fortunate in Iowa, there's a lot of folks that still have old, smaller tractors around, because the kinds of tractors that are useful for vegetables have been used in row crops in the past. So we have a couple of I think we have two tractors that are, or three tractors that are from the 50s, the 40s and 50s. And so those tractors are still around. People have maintained them, or in some cases they've sat for a while but can still be repaired. And so those old tractors are just great for our purposes, and have been great for us to learn on, because there's sort of less mechanically happening on some of the old tractors. And so we've been very grateful to be able to like learn a little bit about how to repair things on our older tractors, because we do have a couple of tractors that are a little bit are from the late 90s.
A little more modern.
A little more modern. And those have just more parts, more moving pieces, and so we have been gradually able to do some minor repairs on those as well.
Oh, good to know. Good to know.
Yeah, something that has been good. And we've also have, like you mentioned, when you're driving a tractor, you're often pulling a piece of equipment, and so we have quite a few pieces of equipment that we're excited to highlight at the field day as well.
Good, good. Tell us about, you have on the list here, you've got an undercutter and tine weeders. That sounds interesting. What's an undercutter?
Both an undercutter and a tine weeder are pieces of equipment that you pull behind a tractor. And the undercutter is something we learned about from Mark Kui at his field day a couple years ago, and it's actually very simple. It's just basically a sharp bar that you sink into the ground, and it can cut under to harvest garlic, or it can cut under to lift up plastic mulch when you're done. And so that is a tool that we ended up getting one fabricated by our local welder. It's because it's so simple. It's just like a bar on a three-point hitch. And that is one of the things that has helped us become more efficient. Being able to harvest the garlic by undercutting it with a tractor has eliminated a lot of back-breaking broad forking, which is also a great tool, but yeah, so that's what an undercutter is.
Good.
And what's a tine weeder?
A tine weeder is it's basically like a giant rake that you pull behind the tractor. And so this can be used to eliminate weeds when your crops are in a like fairly small stage. It can disturb the soil to eliminate weeds when they're just germinating. And we also use it to rake in cover crop seed, which we just did a couple of days ago.
Oh, very good. Very good. Another thing that I do have to ask about, and I'm sure people will come away from this show and say, I wonder what that looks like. On the list of things that you have on your farm, it says you have a bicycle-powered potato washer. That sounds handy.
Yes, that's a tool that we actually made ourselves. We saw a video of one on the internet and decided to make one. And this was another project of Helena, who farms with us, along with some other friends who've mm-hmm. worked here in the past, or friends of ours. And it's basically a barrel, a wooden barrel that is connected with gears and a belt to a bicycle. And so you can make the barrel turn, and then there is a spray nozzle that, so there's water. Am I describing it well?
Yeah. Yeah, so there's like water spraying into the barrel, and you're pedaling the bicycle, so it's spinning the barrel, so the potatoes are bouncing around and getting sprayed. And then, yeah, that's basically it. You can wash other roots in it as well.
That sounds really handy, because you deal in quantities. I just kind of guess, how many potatoes do you produce a year?
I don't know if we've done this math problem.
A lot. Well, you told
me. Yes.
Yeah.
We grow 3/4 of an acre of potatoes.
How many varieties?
We are variety enthusiasts, so I would say we grow like 6 to 8 varieties of potatoes, and we lean on a couple that do really well for us, but we really like to plant a couple of rows of the purple ones and the all red ones, yeah.
Good. You know, sometimes the big machines usually get the big machines on a small farm, but still big machines, they kind of get the get all the attention. But sometimes it's just the small stuff that's really handy. I get a lot of use out of just a plain wheelbarrow, and in the winter I change to a small toboggan. It's just handy. I'm going from one end to the other, and it's nice to be able to have something that is easy. I don't have to start a motor for either one of them. And also, wheelbarrows come in a lot of different sizes. And I learned recently, I really don't need something big that I have to push a lot. I just got myself one little handy red wheelbarrow, and I use that a lot. And also, I've learned to use a scythe. And this is a kind of a modern, or actually they call it a European or Scandinavian scythe that has a straight snath, which is the
blade.
Which is the wooden part it's attached to. Mm-hmm. But once I learned how to use it, something like that. Again, it doesn't have a motor, but it's handy.
What are you scything?
There's always weeds, Donna.
Oh,
and especially around edges of things. I mean, yeah, it's nice to have things, a nice big patch of nettles. Now, I'm not going to go in there and harvest all the nettles and eat them, although you can. Just cutting it down, it's sort of rewarding. Do you have things on your farm that you're just kind of your favorite hand tools?
Yes, we do. I would say our two favorite hand tools are, the first one is just a metal mallet. We move a lot of grounding rods with our electric fencing with the sheep. And if you use a rubber mallet to pound in a grounding rod, it will take a lot more effort than if you use a metal mallet. So this is just something we picked up at Menards one day. It's like a sledgehammer, but it's small and it's light enough that you can wield it with one hand. And it has changed our lives. And it came with a sticker on it that said, "Destroy More." So we call it Destroy More.
Very good. Anything else that you're fond of?
I would also say that we really like the battery-powered Sawzall. We use it, obviously, for chopping down tree branches and stuff. But we also use it to harvest Brussels sprouts and to trim the garlic stems off of the racks after we cure them. So it's a very multi-purpose, very effective tool that also is light enough that you can carry it with you, and is like an approachable power tool for people to learn with.
Very good. See, all these things make the day a little easier, and you can go into supper earlier. I like that. I want to mention again that this is KHOI, and you're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. You can find out more at www.khoifm.org. Welcome back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. We're talking to farmers today. We're talking to farmers Carmen and Maya Black from Sundog Farm. They are part of a wonderful project that seems to be going quite well.
Lots of local food and vegetables and animals. So you guys kind of have a lot of, at least four farmers involved. How do you make decisions and what to grow and how do you collaborate, basically?
That's a great question, and I think it's one that is sort of constantly evolving. We shared earlier a little bit about our story, about how we got started and everyone sort of became interested over time. And so the answer to that question has kind of changed over time. But I think that we all have different sort of areas of interest. So I head up a lot of the planning on the sort of CSA and vegetable side of things. And one nice thing about continuing from year to year is you can modify last year's plan instead of needing to make a brand new plan. And so that's a good format for us to, at the end of every season, we do reflect as a group about what went well, what we can do better. And then I can kind of take those group reflections and turn them into a spreadsheet, basically, right? And then Maya does a lot of similar things with the grazing plan for the sheep and goats. And now Carlos also grazes meat chickens on the farm. And so that's sort of, we're incorporating that in as well. And the laying hens are at a different location where they stay, but they also have constant access to grazing. So sort of a lot of animal planning, and Maya sort of does a lot of that. Again, we do group reflections. And then as I mentioned, Carlos has his meat chicken business, and Helena does a lot of the planning around our new processing kitchen. So we all kind of have different areas, while then we also collaborate.
Lots of things to keep up in the air all at once. Is there any time? And how do you unwind? How do you just kind of recenter yourselves when you have to?
That's a great question. I mean, something that I like about farming is that there's always something new to do. And so I find, you know, farming itself is very interesting. I think that we try to get off the farm, and also having many additional employees on the farm is that we can sub in for each other. So if someone wants to go on a little trip or something, that's more possible with more people in our experience.
Oh, I bet that would. That would be a good thing. So you learn from the past. You look forward to the future. What are some of the, you're kind of in the middle of growing season, but have you had any new vegetable, new animal? What was a unexpected favorite thing that happened this year so far?
Well, this is just our second year growing ginger.
Ah.
So that has been really exciting. We grew that for the first time last year. And I kind of like the second year of trying something new because you learn from the first year.
We're doing a slightly better job.
Yeah. And it went great last year, but we definitely figured out how to make it just go a little bit smoother in terms of being able to weed it and that kind of thing. So that's pretty exciting, I think.
Good. Do you have to grow ginger undercover, or can you just grow it in the field?
It's tropical.
Yes. Yeah, you can. I think you can grow it in the field. We're growing it in a hoop house because you can extend the season a little bit, and it just does. It can get a little bigger, is what we've been told.
Ah, very good. Ginger in Iowa. See, I like that.
Oh, we haven't asked you about the goats. What do you do with the goats?
Well, we have Alpine dairy goats, and currently they we're we're not producing milk as a product. They do a lot of important work cleaning up spent vegetable fields and keeping the sort of edges of the farm spruced up. But the goats are currently more of a cleanup and restoration crew than a milk producing crew.
And handy little things they can be too. How nice. Very good. Well.
And I wanted to say, my favorite thing from this past year is another thing that we've been working on for a couple of years, but we, learned how to shear our own sheep. And this year was our third year doing it. And specifically me, Carmen, and Helena have been learning how to shear. And this year was like by far our most successful. I think we're all getting the hang of it. And
how many do you have to shear?
Our flock of ewes is like in the 40 to 50 range.
Woo!
So if you break that down, it's like 10 to 15 per person.
And what do you do with the wool?
Sorry, we're just having a dog and cat interaction under the table.
I saw the kitten.
So like we said earlier, our sheep are not a very like refined wool quality. Currently we don't do very much with the wool.
Mm-hmm. Well, wool compost, it also makes great insulation. There's a lot of things you can do with not quite good wool. See, it's one of those life skills, Donna, shearing a sheep. Who would have thought? I think this is a good thing to learn. Well, we want to thank you for being with us today and give us your information on how one can connect up with Sundog Farm and Local Harvest CSA.
Well, you can come to our field day on August 20th. Please RSVP if you'd like to attend for lunch. Lunch will be at noon. The tool portion for beginning farmers will be in the morning from 9 to noon, and you do need to pre-register for that part because it'll be a hands-on tool workshop.
So the RSVP and the registration is through Practical Farmers of Iowa Field Days, is that right?
practicalfarmers.org/fieldays. Yes, it is. Good.
Yeah. Yep, please. And then from 1 to 3 is we're going to be talking about collaboration and scaling up. Also, if you or are a Spanish speaker or know any Spanish speakers interested in growing poultry, Carlos will be leading a tour of his meat chicken operation with an interpreter that will be intended for Spanish speakers. So that will also be happening from 1 to 3. And then if you are a landowner or a land seeker, from 3:30 to 4:30, we will be hosting a land access discussion. A big key to what we've done as farmers has been being able to access land from Susan, who retired, as well as a few neighbors that we've been able to rent from. And so we will be talking about that.
And there's lunch. There's lunch. Tell us the menu. What are you guys cooking?
We'll be preparing lunch, and our plan is to make pulled pork with pork from West Fork Farm, and potato salad, greens, and smoked ham hock from Over the Moon Farm, and peach cobbler from Turkey Creek Orchard.
Ooh,
and
ooh.
Our friends, the bread bakers at the local Crumb, will be providing buns, and then we'll have some baked good treats from White Tree Bakery as well. So we're really trying to feature a lot of other local farms and businesses with the meal.
You are doing wonderful things, and thank you for being with us, and also thank you for being part of Practical Farmers of Iowa to open up your farm to all these, not just your farm, but all of these good ideas that are great, just great. We've been talking to Carmen and Maya Black from Sundog Farm and Local Harvest CSA. They're good people to get to know.
Yeah, and the date, once again, is Sunday, August 20th. If you want to visit the farm, you can go to Practical Farmers of Iowa and Field Days and register.
Wonderful. Good. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Good.
Okay, all you young folk out there, believe it or not, there was a time when we did not have electricity, especially rural areas in Iowa. Rural electric really didn't, come for quite a while. Some of our parents and grandparents didn't have electricity in their farmhouses, but things needed to be done. I'm going to share a little bit here from a book called Little Heathens, Hard Times and High Spirits on an Iowa Farm During the Great Depression by Mildred Armstrong Kalish. Mildred Kalish is a retired professor of English who grew up in Garrison, Iowa, and taught at several colleges, including the University of Iowa. This story is Mildred Kalish's story of growing up on her grandparents' Iowa farm in the depths of the Great Depression. And this is not a sad story of suffering, but it's a tale of childhood. She talks about her family who lived with their grandparents. So I'm going to read from a few paragraphs here, thinking about things that we take for granted. This is from a chapter called Wash Day. How things used to get done. Remember, no electricity for water pumps, heating water for running the washing machine, for drying, and this is how it went. Though Monday was the official wash day throughout the farm community, preparations usually started Sunday night when all the dirty clothes were collected, sorted, and scrutinized. Mama would ask all the men and boys to empty out their pants pockets and shirt pockets and brush away the chaff, the dirt, alfalfa seeds, and barley beards. All the clothes were then put into a soak in a large galvanized tub of water. The next step was for a couple of big kids to bring the copper oval-shaped boiler up from the cellar and place it on the Monarch kitchen range. And here's where the cooperation began. We little kids would pump cistern water into a 3-gallon galvanized buckets, and the boys would carry them two at a time to fill the boiler and the reservoir on the range. We used cistern water, which is rainwater collected and stored in the cistern, usually 30 to 40 feet deep and lined with stones, because rainwater, unlike well water, is soft. In fact, there is a saying in Iowa that well water is so hard you have to bite it out of the cup. But since it doesn't allow suds to form and is harsh on the skin, washing was done in soft cistern water. The laundry soap was also prepared Sunday night. Grandpa shredded 1 1/2 bars of P&G Fells Naphtha into a green marbleized graniteware pan and put it on the back of the stove until the next day.
Well, at least they didn't have to make their own soap.
I think that was an option, but they must have been a high-rolling farm family if they bought the Fells Naphtha. Once wash water was brought to a boil, Monday morning, the heavy, awkward, round wooden washing machine was moved into the kitchen, filled with water, and the soap added all the clothes were washed in the same water in order of whiteness and cleanliness. White clothes first, bed linens, followed by hand and dish towels, colored clothes, and finally the work shirts and work clothes. In order to operate the washing machine paddles, once the clothes were put in, you had to do this by hand. Push, pull, push, pull, push, pull. 15 minutes for every load. That's where both the big kids and little kids took turns. Once the clothes were clean, using a wooden wash stick, we lifted them out of the steaming water and put them through hard rubber rollers of the hand wringer into the rinse water, and then wring them again through the rubber rollers. And this too was a manual thing, two-person activity. One person turning the handle of the wringer while another rinsed the clothes by hand, fed them through rubber rollers, and ejected them into a wicker wash basket below. Then the whole process started over again with the next load of clothes. We considered it a badge of honor to get all the clothes on the line by 10 o'clock in the morning. There were a few years where the women in the town of Garrison, Iowa, hung their panties and bras inside a pillowcase to conceal them from the eyes of any lascivious male who passed by while the unmentionables were drying. But people made fun of this practice, and soon it was abandoned. I don't recall ever engaging in that bit of silliness on the farm. That was a little bit from Mildred Kalish's story of growing up on her grandparents' farm called Little Heathens, Hard Times During the Great Depression.
Donna, we have a podcast. Tell folks how we can
get the podcast. Wherever you listen to podcasts, you just type in Donna Lana, which is one word, D-O-N-N-A-L-O-N-N-A. Second word, kitchen, and you can hear us in the podcast format in addition to listening to us on the radio.
Huh. Who knew we could end up doing this, Donna? We started talking about food farming and things on the radio about 10 years ago, and now we've got a podcast. And we're on the radio, too, at KHOI Community Radio. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We come to you live every Tuesday at noon, and we also are repeated Tuesday evening and on this fine radio station. And you can go to www.khoifm.org. You can stream, you can download, you can check out our webpage. There are recipes there. Lots of things you can find out. Support this fine community radio station. We've had music by the Barn Owl Band. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.